Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 19th, 1998, and in the Koinonia Fireside building this morning we have Tom Smith. His session number is 98-2, and it's titled Natural History of Railroad Creek Valley. Let's listen in.
Again, avalanche area there with snow coming down into it, you can get a little bit of a cooler, wetter regime than the surrounding forest. And Aspen is adapted to avalanche chutes. The slide was the same area before. The snows we had in 96, 97 basically destroyed that. And what we have is this today. But Aspen primarily regenerates by root sprouting, and it can come back from roots in the general area and the destroyed stumps, and that stand will rapidly become trees again. The other disturbance in this valley historically has been fire. This doesn't show a fire, but this larger surviving Douglas fir on the left, the darker band you see climbing up on the left side of that tree is an old fire char from the fire that came through here 100 years ago. Most of the rest of the trees you see in this picture are ones that have grown back since that fire. Tree strategies for surviving fire, like Douglas fir and ponderosa pine, is fairly thick bark as insulation. Also, the deeper root system there is somewhat fire resistant. This area, again, off right off the 10-mile trail, not too far outside the village, is all trees that have come back in after that fire, commonly called second growth. Primarily Douglas fir, growing fairly well. Switching a little bit here, this big old cottonwood up toward the miner's village, you might have seen this cavity at the base of it, gets you thinking about what could be living in that, and I'd like to move on to a little bit about wildlife that inhabits the valley. It's pretty typical of what normally lives in the Cascade Forest and on the eastern slopes. So I'll start off, we'll see if you can see it. Definitely a lot of them around the village. You all see the ground squirrel? Okay. Starting off small and working larger, we have four different types of squirrels in this valley.
I don't see the ground squirrel.
Okay.
Put it out there.
I will.
I suspect I don't see it.
This is kind of one of these opposites. You don't look towards the light, you look towards the dark.
Right.
Hiding right in here. There's his ears.
Maybe because
he
doesn't look like he's on a branch.
No, he just scampered up in there. If you can't see there, all you have to do is step outside and you'll see more than you can. But we have chipmunks, we have the ground squirrel, we have you might have seen a few places around the village also the Douglas, the pine squirrel, more brown, reddish color.
What's the ground squirrel doing in the tree?
Well, the ones outside the village, they actually act like wild squirrels, and this one was up cutting seeds out of this maple. Ground squirrel means primarily they nest in the ground.
What type of ground squirrel are they generally?
I think these are the golden mantled ground squirrels. We also have flying squirrels in the valley. Let me figure out at dusk, you might get lucky and see one gliding down out of a tree. A little bit larger animals that we have around here. We have this rabbit looking thing that you've seen out here. Okay. You notice its white feet? Okay, that's a snowshoe hare. And in October it'll start becoming more and more white until when the snows are here, it's all white. Camouflage, survival, adaptation. In the springtime, when the snow disappears, they're at a loss because they're still trying to turn brown, and the white rabbit shows up pretty easily in the woods. We also have pikas or pikas, conies, rock rabbits, a small little, not much bigger than a hamster sort of thing. Cute little squeaks that lives up in the rocks. Higher up in the valley, you might hear whistling marmots. a little animal that's like a mouse with big ears. Is that the pikas?
Mm-hmm. Pikas are larger than a mouse.
Are they? These little guys, cubes of bugs here, they're big ears. Kind of, does that ring a bell? Coming in on the Cascade Pass area?
Big ears.
No. Huh. Well, I'll have to see if I can find a picture.
Okay.
Mouse. Deer mouse, maybe?
Deer mouse.
Yeah.
No.
This was taken up by the incinerator up near the garage. This is a pine marten. And I guess they're, in some areas, they're fairly rare. In this valley, the population rises and declines, kind of following the ground squirrel and mouse population influx, too. This was a few years ago, and several of them around the village became pretty used to people. There was one year there were so many pine martens in the valley that, well, they weren't quite as bad as a ground squirrel problem, but I think in the library there's a photograph of one that was in this building in the library. They're fairly commonly sighted. They're pretty ferocious predators, and they like to eat chipmunks and smaller rodents. So I wish we had a few of them around right now to kind of balance the population out again. Some of the animals eat animals, others eat trees. You can have damage to seedlings from squirrels. They will put the shoots off in the springtime and eat the buds. You have porcupines that can eat smaller trees and climb up and girdle the tops of larger trees. You can also have rabbit damage on young seedlings as well.
We were hiking up along the lake and we found along the trail little pine tufts, a pine needle. So, and I was wondering if, you know, squirrels were cutting them off or...
What's starting to happen now is that the squirrels are going up and cutting the cones, and that activity will be increasing into the fall. And when they clip the cones, they'll get as close to the can, and if they clip part of the branch containing the needles, the whole clump will fall down, then they'll sort that out at the bottom and snip the cone off, take it off, dash it, or eat it.
Will these trees survive here?
Well, if they've been girdled completely around, I don't think these will survive. If they leave a portion of the bark intact on the tree,
right,
then it has a chance to recover.
Probably gone.
Yeah, these are probably gone. They were taken a couple of years ago. We have beaver in the valley. We also have mountain beaver in the valley. And there's a big difference. The regular beaver is the one that makes the ponds. They also live in the creek. And in the wintertime, they become more active as they're cutting or actually in the fall and winter, they're actively cutting food. I know that I think in the past years, the village has heard them, there's trees being cut down out behind them.
Are there any active now left in this area?
If you go out and check up the beaver ponds between here and Heart Lake, you might see them. Also, I know on the inlet stream to Heart Lake, there's been beaver in there. And there are places in the valley between here and Heart Lake, if you get way off the trail and wander around, you can find either old abandoned beaver ponds filling in or some that I think have seasonal use. There used to be a lot of trapping in this valley, and I think the person who last did any serious trapping lives down at Donkin. I think he gave that up probably 10, 15 years ago. So they're probably surviving quite nicely. Mountain beaver is a small, very elusive little critter, kind of nocturnal. It's about this big, no tail. It doesn't live in the water, but it lives along wet areas, and it eats shrubs and wildflowers. On the Heart Lake Trail, as you get close to Holden Creek, you might see holes about 6 inches in diameter right alongside the trail in that wet area. And that's from those animals. We have, what's that?
That's a bear.
Okay. We have bear up here. Different colors. Black bears can be this color, black, cinnamon, blonde. (Clears throat) how many bears are in that picture?
Three.
You see the third one?
Yeah, in the back.
Yeah. You see the
right in there.
This was with a telephoto lens, right?
This actually wasn't with a telephoto lens. I haven't heard of any real nasty bear encounters. Most of the time, when you see them, they've already seen you, or shortly afterwards, they will see you or smell you and wander off. And just because of the number of people in the valley, sometimes you can see them quite close. Bear populations have come and gone. A number of years ago, they didn't have the composting system set up. And so all the trash, all the food scraps were taken out and dumped into ditches and the tailings. These ditches were kept open until full, and then they'd be filled in. So the bears, whose natural territory, I think females is 9-10 miles, I think maybe more, and the male territory is larger. This whole valley was a great place for bear. The population, you'd see bears all over the place. You'd see them on the tailings, going to the tailings. You'd find plastic wrappers and their scat way down the valley, way up high. Come for miles. And one year they decided, when they initiated the composting system, they basically shut off a lot of their food supply. So all these bears have been used to coming here, just like the issues in some of the national parks. These bears showed up for their snack and it wasn't being served. So they started coming into the village. And there were bears that would be up on the second story of porches after food, just like the chipmunks are. We had a bear that broke into the kitchen, and kind of like a Walt Disney movie, it got into the flour. I think it got into some honey. You had to be careful when you were going outside of the buildings at night that you wouldn't come out too fast because there could be a bear right there on the porch. No injuries, no accidents, but it was pretty wild for a while.
How long ago was that, Tom?
That was, I think it got bad in the summer of 89, no, sorry, 79.
Because we were here when the bear broke into the kitchen.
Okay.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was. There would be bears out after they do the barbecue outside. Rather than chipmunks nibbling on those bars, there were bears. It was wild. That did kind of have an unfortunate ending because the game department came up. Since it was a problem and people were concerned, they got the word about it. They did come up. They shot 5 of them, took them down and dumped them down the valley. And also the word got out that there was a bear problem at Holden, so there's a lot of hunters that came up here that fall, and bears were being shot fairly close in and around the village, and I saw some hunting styles that I didn't really appreciate too much. Shooting a bear, running off, and they disappear off with the tailings, and they say, well, we think we wounded it, but we're not sure, don't know if it ran off or died, or whether or not it would show up being pretty angry the next day. I don't have any photos of cougars. There are cougar in the valley, and again, there's been some great stories of people bumping into them. So far, all the encounters have been awesome, but harmless. Some hikers had to walk around one that was sunning itself on the switchbacks up on the way up to Holden Lake. It just sat there and watched them until they walked around, and it continued to lay there sunning itself. There were some people that were camping out at the ballpark one time, and they saw what they thought were 2 deer come bounding down out of the aspen. As soon as they broke down into the clearing, the first one was a deer, the second one was a cougar. And as they watched from their tent, the cougar brought down the deer in the ballpark right in front of them. After it killed the deer, it saw them and drug it off to the far side of the ballpark. They hightailed it and spent the night in the village. The next day they went out there and found where the cougar had been feeding on it and covered it up. I don't know if they realized the cougar was probably watching them, because they will cache food and they'll also hang out nearby and keep an eye on it. I would have paid to see that deer being taken on there. That's a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Was that recently or was that a while back?
Again, that maybe early 80s.
Uh-huh. Have there been many bear in the village now?
I think probably not in the village as much as in the perimeter. I know that whenever they can, they'll still go up. The scent of the compost bins will attract them. And you can see bear tracks around there, maybe sight bear in the vicinity. Somebody was just telling me that the fence was down a little while ago, or it wasn't hot enough. They have an electric fence there to discourage them. You know, there was bears getting in there just a few weeks ago, so. One of the, another impact that bears can have on the woods is some bears can get a sweet tooth. And subalpine fir here and lodgepole pine in the springtime, when the tree is first becoming active, leaving dormancy and beginning to get ready to grow, a lot of the stored energy, the food in the roots, as it's coming up through the tree there, it's very sugary, has a very high sugar content. And some bears have learned that, and they will come to a tree like this, claw the base of the tree, ripping off the bark, so they can eat that real sweet candy. And not all bears do that. There will be a bear that knows that trick, and it will teach it to its offspring. You might have a family of bears doing it. But in Western Washington, with a lot of the big timber companies, where they have plantations of Douglas fir, you get bears doing that too, and that. Every young tree being lost is a potential profit down the road. So for a while, when they'd find an area where a bear would work going and work in an area, and they would come back, they wouldn't hit the same tree, but they could work through an area and damage a lot of trees. So there was basically a program where they would just go out and hunt the bear in the area and shoot them all. And a person who'd done that for a number of years, the more he shot them, the more he hunted them, the more he understood a little bit about the bear. And he realized that, one, it's a learned behavior, so you don't need to shoot every bear that's in the valley. There might be one or two bears that are causing the problem. And the second thing he found out is that it's only for a short period of time. And that rather than killing the bear, that you could actually set up bear feeding stations, feeding these big granule sweetened pellets, that they'll eat that until there are other food, and I guess I should focus on that too. In the springtime, there's not a lot of other food sources for them. They'll go out and they'll be eating the grass and stuff. A lot of their prey and a lot of their food it just isn't developed yet. So that's one of the reasons they would hit the trees and cause the damage. So by setting up these feeding stations, just for a short period of time, that would take care of the problem. They would prefer to just walk up and eat out of these bins, this pelletized food, than to go and damage trees. They also are part of the food chain in the process of helping decompose logs. Rotten wood will attract carpenter ants. The carpenter ants excavate that wood. As that wood rots, the bears love to feed on grubs and ant eggs and ant larvae. So. You'll see places along the valley here, old stumps and logs are sometimes ripped apart. And it's pretty impressive to see a bear working on a stump like that. You see just the fur and the muscles rippling, shivering in the sunlight as this thing is just tearing these logs apart. You get a sense of the power that they have. We have various birds in the village. You've seen some of the swallows. We have robins. A lot of the birds are fairly typical to what inhabit and use the Pacific Flyway along here. We have small owls, pygmy owls. We also have spotted owl, great horned owl, and the spotted owl's more aggressive cousin, the barred owl.
What breed of owl is that? What species?
I'm going to just kind of guess a little bit and call it a pygmy owl. It's pretty small, very small. Occasionally, you'll see a bald eagle flying around here. Quite often on eastern Washington, you'll see more typically golden eagles. And there's different sorts of wildlife in the village here. There's nothing down here. I have a picture, I don't know if you can see it very well, a little spider web in the corner, and that kind of gets me into my next topic of insects. Yes. some of you may notice the some fresh stumps around the village, and this is a picture, I guess, while it has a lot of beautiful fall color, that evergreen shouldn't be that color. That evergreen that you're seeing there is now a stump.
And the art camp, trees have a disease, didn't they? You had to cut them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. The cause of this problem is a very small little insect. I talked about it a little bit yesterday on the walk. And I have a picture of hundreds of them right here. All those little white fluffs are from this balsam woolly adelgid. It's like an aphid. It was imported from Europe a number of years ago, and it is pretty host specific to true firs, some alpine fir here, silver fir on the west side. And it just sucks the sap out of the top portion of the tree and on the branches, but as it's sucking the sap, kind of like a mosquito or whatever, it's basically injecting a toxin, a compound which is very toxic to the tree. And I think perhaps they were attracted to some of the trees in the village because they were under stress in the first place. The ones up near where the ark is now, and the one down by the loading dock where areas where there's a lot of foot traffic, soil compaction. So the stressed tree might have attracted them, and they massively attacked it over a period of years and killed the tree. Some of the trees that aren't dead around here but around the village perimeter, the young subalpine fir, on the branches down below you can start to see white or grayish lumps developing like there in a pyre. That's a swelling. It indicates that they have been feeding on that tree, and the tree is showing some reaction to the toxins that are in it. Really isn't much we can do about those insects, short of getting a high-pressure sprayer up here and hosing down the tree with chemicals. That's not going to happen. This is kind of what the area where the ark is looked like not that long ago. And there was a whole series of trees. They all became infected, and here's one being cut down. There's another type of small, same little fluffy aphid that you'll see that affects the spruce trees. The one by the river sauna, if you look up higher in it, it may look like these are cones. That may look like a cone from a distance. That same cottony little aphid will get into the buds. And as it's eating in there, as the bud releases and starts to grow in the spring, you get this weird, it's all hollow inside. It's like everything is kind of expanded. It'll kill that branch tip. And they won't kill the tree, they just affect the foliage. They may slow the growth down a little bit, but they're out there, and that's just something else that we can see around here.
There's no natural predator for that insect?
There is some predation by other insects and birds. I know with the one that's affecting the true firs around here, it's native to Europe, and I think the animals, the insects around here, they can prey on it, but they don't have like a primary host or predator. We have a lot of willow in this valley that's been dying over the past 10 years or so. There's been a lot more of it just right around the village. I think you can still see some dead willow just west of the hike house. Big stands of it up near Heart Lake Trail, about halfway up there, and there's some on the other side of the valley that you can see. It's all been dying off recently, and it's part of the natural process, a cycle. But what's been killing it off, or helping kill it off, is a small little beetle. It's a weevil called the poplar and willow borer. And it lays its egg in there, and the larvae just crawls through the tree and riddles it. You can see this has been attacked by a whole bunch of them. And I wish that there were still some active willow around, and this was the right time of the year, because the weevil is, it's this cute little bumpy thing with almost a little bit of pink on it. And I guess the neatest thing I like about that little critter is if you find one and if you pick it, hold it in your hand, and if you bug it, you can poke it, push it around. It has this funny little squeak. But it's pretty much devastated a lot of the willow in the valley. Some of the willow that has not completely died, it can try to sprout from the base, grow back again, and there might be another cycle of this animal later on. This was from the west side, actually, but we have numerous beetles. Of all the insects in the woods around here in the forest, the beetles are probably the largest species, the largest family group. These ones, it's called hips, and it bores into the log and it bores into the woods and it makes little tiny pinholes all through the wood itself. And they will be attracted to the scent, the smell of a dying tree. And like this log that was cut in the springtime, as soon as a tree is cut, as it initially starts to decompose, it can release a very faint alcohol odor. And these bugs, I'm not sure if they're keen specifically on the alcohol, but it seems like that's a pretty good guess. I've been out some times in my backyard having a beer, and I've been visited by little bugs too. So anyway, they get in there, and once they find a dying tree and they're successful in boring into the tree, because a healthy tree will actually develop pitch at the site where they're trying to enter in through the little hole in the bark, and will physically squeeze them out like a caulking gun, push them right back out of the entry hole of pitch. Lots of times they'll be encapsulated in that pitch. That's where we get some of the amber, the old insects in rock. But if they're successful getting in there, then the bug itself will release a pheromone which attracts all the other ones around there. It says, here's a good time, let's party. And they all show up, and you can see this log has been peppered with them. Some of the white that you see underneath is actually the boring powder that's dropped off the log in the rock as well. This is just what the boring powder looks like up close. They've bored through the bark, and that is the wood.
How deep do they go?
They'll usually just stay around in the sapwood area. So they usually bore in about this much, and just kind of work that sapwood area over. As they mature, they'll work their way back out and rest and go through their larval stage, become adults just underneath that bark. And then the next spring, they all crawl out of the bark as adults and go look for another source of wood. Another bark beetle that we have around here, and it is the bark beetle. There was a tree I was showing some people yesterday on the trail, and while I was talking about this particular tree, I looked up the hill and I saw another tree, still alive, but it has a lot of this brown boring powder on it. And they're attacking that one actively right now. This bark beetle, it just crawls along and feeds on the inner bark of the tree, in the cambium. If you see bark that's peeled over, they leave a real pretty pattern. It almost looks kind of like a spider. And what they do is the adult female will bore a hole in, and then it'll work its way in a line underneath the bark. And every so often it will lay a little egg in a little niche off to the side gallery, as it goes. Then as those larvae hatch out, they all radiate out like this. And as they radiate out, as they're eating, they also get larger, they eat more. And so you have this beautiful pattern of in the inner bark from these beetles as they chew through it and leave the pattern. A lot of sticks that you'll find around here, if you look at the sticks, that's from a different type of beetle that's actually working the wood right underneath the cambium layer. And the same thing, this beautiful pattern of what the bugs have done. Where these bugs can cause a problem is if the population is up so high and you do have a few weakened trees, they'll all be attracted to that specific tree. They can also spread to other trees. And they can, if there's enough beetles in there that get into a healthy tree, they will just continue to eat around the inner bark there, girdle the tree, and kill it. So the forest industry spends a lot of time studying these so they can figure out ways to stop them. So again, a little close-up of that orangish inner bark color from the bark beetle. I talked a little bit yesterday and about beetles being attracted by smell. I was, just before I came up to Holden, I was on a fire by Sky Comish, and I was there working the fire. The day was reported in the evening. The next day I came back to do a little investigation work on it. And as I was walking around taking pictures of some trees, these little beetles had already found the tree. And there are beetles in it, that are attracted, they can sense infrared. And it's explained to me that and I guess this just shows the complexity of even something as simple as a beetle, that some of these beetles, in order to sense infrared, they have a little hole in them that is, I think, the wavelength of infrared, that's the shape, that's the height of this hole, and then halfway in, they have a little appendage sticking out, which is like half a wavelength. And so as infrared goes in there, it basically triggers this little sensor inside, and they can follow it. And they can come for miles. My professor in entomology at the university told me that, is it Candlestick Park in California?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, San Francisco. Okay, except they used to, when they have concerts or whatever, they'll put their lights. Okay. They get bugs coming in. They'll be attracted to that. Okay. I was on a fire down in southern Oregon where those sort of bugs were attracted, the beetle was attracted to the fire. And there were so many of them in the area that when they're looking for freshly killed trees in the fire area, they'll just go in and start landing on things. And a hot firefighter to them was somewhat similar to a tree. And these were very tough little beetles because they'd land on you. And they do the first thing that they need to do. They need to bite in a little egg niche, okay? So they bite you.
Oh.
You'd swat it instinctively, and you wouldn't kill it. The beetle would just fold up its legs, drop down inside your shirt collar, and you wouldn't notice it for a while. And then all along, all of a sudden, now you've got something inside of you, and it starts wiggling, and bam, it bites you again. Mm-hmm. And firefighters, I mean, there wouldn't be one bug doing this to you. We had firefighters basically just about losing it on the fire line. They'd start turning the hoses on themselves, and I mean, it was phenomenal.
But they knew what it was.
Well, actually, the people running the fire, they weren't really sure, because they started handing out insect repellent.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't do any good at all.
It wouldn't.
What does?
Well, that's, I guess you just go away from the fire. You go away from them.
What kind of beetles were these again? The bark beetles?
These are actually, this is a second type of beetle, not the bark beetle, but this is a wood boring beetle. And this beetle is the type that this makes some of the grubs you see in the wood. And there's two types in this valley. There's the round-headed, the flat-headed. One is kind of almond-shaped, and that's also called the shorthorn. It's a buprestid beetle. And they make little lens-shaped holes in the wood in the tunnels. And their larvae are fairly bizarre looking. They've got all these little segments on it with a triangular head. They almost look like a little monster snake larvae or something like that. The other one is a round-headed longhorn beetle. I don't know if you've any seen those around here. Beetle with big, long, whip antennas. You might see them in the summer. A lot of them have already been out doing their thing flying around, but they're pretty impressive. They get easily this size around the village with antennae that are 2 or 3 inches long. And they're really neat. There's a ponderous pine borer that can get maybe about as big as your thumb. And when you see them flying, you might mistake it for a small hummingbird. When they fly like that, they're pretty slow. I hosted a tour of entomology students from the University of Washington up here one time. We were down near the top of switchbacks and where some of the watch bowl or the ponderosa pine was. And this one teaching assistant was poking around underneath the bark there while the professor was lecturing. And he was getting pretty excited and pulled something out, and he had it in his hand. And the professor was lecturing, and all of a sudden this guy went, "Ah!" And he opened up his hand, and he had one of these larvae hanging from his finger, because the larvae are the ones that chew through wood, right? They got two sharp little pinchers at the end, and it bit into his hand. And the professor was trying to pull it out. He didn't want it to be hurt. He needed to
collect and take it back and hurt him. No, don't hurt him. He said, maybe if I just ignore it, it'll you know, loosen up its grip there. And he tried to ignore it for a while, and professor just started talking to him. Also, he let out a yell. And again, this thing had finally just ripped it off, and it was bleeding. The thing had just hung on big time. So be careful when you pick them up. The thing about these wood boring beetles, and they will actually bore all the way in through the tree, is that typically they have a 2-year life cycle. It takes them a while to bore around the inside and go in and mature and come out as adults. But if the tree they're in, if the log gets dry, their whole metabolism slows down and it takes a long time for them to become an adult. Sometimes a real long time. This is from our house. It was built in the early 30s. The local mills around there were milling a bunch of large old Douglas fir from the forest that had been burned some time before. A lot of the wood was on the ground. So a lot of the logs that they were milling had these larvae in them. And when the lumber was dried back then, it wasn't kiln dried, air dried, some of these bugs stayed alive. And they just move very slowly. And I guess what this shows here is that there are different fir flooring boards along here. And I discovered this when I was going to sand the floor and take the old finish off. There are ones that had lived in here after the boards were made into the flooring and after the floor was laid and finished, because you got a bug that went from a larvae that crawled from one board across to the other one. See that? Two different boards there. They were living in the floor for a while. And they can live a long, long time. A year or so ago, I found one of those oval, almond-shaped, flat-headed wood borers that had come out of the wall here through the paint. Now this is, 60-some years after the house was built. And they're not coming in, they're not landing on the house and starting new wood like carpet ants can do. These were in the wood when the house was made, so it's kind of phenomenal that it would take that long. Kind of makes holes in the wood, kind of. Anybody can tell me what that is? Mm-hmm. Actually, that's a little flying saucer that slammed in.
How dare I say that, but I was afraid I'd sound cool.
I'll be the fool.
Yeah, that's a shelf fungus. That's the fruiting body of a fungus. This particular type of fungus attacks and feeds on deadwood. I use this as an introduction to the next topic of funguses and forest diseases. When you first get off the boat down at Chelan or at Lucerne and all the way up and through here, you'll see some Dr. Seuss type trees. funny clumps in it, things that just don't look like your typical expectation of a tree. And that's from a parasitic plant that's adapted itself to living in trees and living under the bark of trees. And it's the dwarf mistletoe up here. And just about every tree in the valley has its own specific type of mistletoe that works on that tree. The ones you see back here is Douglas fir mistletoe. And what it does is it messes up the tree's allocation of food, where the tree would normally be sending some food down to the roots and some up to all the branches and evenly allocating the food. This dwarf mistletoe interrupts that and has most of the nutrients come to the site where the mistletoe is growing. That's how it survives. And as it does that, it stimulates fantastic growth rates of the twigs, the needles around it, and you get these woody brooms, where most of that is the Douglas fir tree, long needles, incredible growth on it, really lush growth, but also the plants in there as well. Here's some elsewhere. And as it's growing in the tree, again, since it's stealing nutrients, the tree is suffering elsewhere, and you can have the tree start to limp, its roots will begin to die, the top will begin to die. This is actually a ponderosa pine down near Lucerne.
And this, the plant that you see on the ponderosa pine, it grows quite visible, you can see that. It has these tiny little, almost like pomegranate-sized little green seeds on them. And the seed is encapsulated with a very flexible outer coat, kind of like a water balloon, with a viscous liquid inside. And as the seed develops, that bag around it just has more and more liquid in it, under more and more pressure, until finally when the seed is ripe and it's disturbed by a gust of wind, that whole water bag breaks off, and that seed is shot right out of that flexible bag at about 80, 90 feet per second. I mean, if you take the seed there and you shoot it, and it stings, it comes out of there. It's also a very sticky seed, so as it breaks off and shoots out, it'll stick to another tree. If it's the same host, the ponderosa pine, that seed will then be able to send a root work. It's physically force its way down inside the bark and begin a whole process of growing in there. And you can see how the branch that typically would be getting smaller as you go up to the branch end, it's larger where these plants are. Railroad Creek Valley used to have a lot more white pine in it. There's still scattered white pine around here. I think the United States used to have a lot more white pine. The white pine blister rust was introduced, I think, from Germany, I believe, in the 20s. That disease actually, I think, originated over in Asia and slowly worked its way across into Europe. It's been introduced here. There are more genetic varieties, resistant varieties of white pine over near Siberia in that area that we're standing. But the white pine that developed here never had some of the resistance to the white pine. So the white pine blister rust that's attacked the trees here has really devastated white pine throughout the United States and the valley. And this is what it looks like, the fruiting body, a little orangish, a little bumpy formations on it. There's some up there. I'm at the next slide. When it's touched, you see almost like pollen, that stuff just comes out of it. And what it will do, it has alternate hosts. From the white pine, where it does its damage, the spores will go to the currant bush. It will live and develop on the currant bush, and then from the currant bush, the spores will be released and it'll come back to white pine and kill the white pine. A long time ago, they thought if they could eradicate all the currant, they could stop the disease. And because white pine was a commercially important species, there was a currant bush eradication program. People would be scouring the hills, digging up currant bushes all over the place. But they didn't realize that these spores can travel. If they get up in the upper air, they can go for a long way, 300 miles. And they realized that trying to destroy the current, you couldn't stop the disease out. It wasn't effective. And eventually, I think this might be the same tree or one nearby, we'll kill it. A couple places where we have a lot of lodgepole pine, down by 10 Mile Falls. If you follow that trail down the road, you go through a white pine or a lodgepole pine stand. Also down near 9 Mile, also on the way to Heart Lake. You might see something like this bumpy stuff. This is the western gall rust. Again, a disease that will get in there and cause this funny growth of the wood. And you end up seeing these little wooden balls on the branches or in the middle. It'll even affect the young ones if it gets started. It's kind of cute, but that will never really grow into a tree. This is another type of fruiting body of a fungus. This type will infect the tree through dead branches. The spores drift around and land on a dead limb, and they'll be able to work their way into the heart of the tree, and then they start to rot out the heartwood. If you see very many of these on the trees, the tree is fairly rotted inside. Other trees that have rots that affect the base of them, like this tree here, you can see that it's unusual taper down at the base of it. That's infected by this cowpie fungus, and that's affecting a lot of trees around the valley here. It comes in through basal scars, dead wood at the base of the tree, and will slowly rot up at the base and the heart of the tree, working its way upward. The tree, in response to that, will try to form pitch around that the fungus in there to try to encapsulate it. It'll also try to put more wood around the base because it needs that for strength, and you'll see the swelling as a result. Another type of conk, we have them on both conifer and on hardwoods. And eventually, as the rot gets to a certain point, the tree, the structure will fail. Another type of disease which actually can spread fairly fast from root contact and travels through the ground is the yellow laminated root rot. If you ever see it around in an area like this, you can actually take the wood and pull it apart by the rings. It just looks like a sheet of paper where you can just, you know, here's one, here's both. Just delaminates the tree. And you have some scattered throughout the valley. There's also some up below Honeymoon Heights. I've been watching that grow. If the conditions are right, that can spread out through the forest at a rate of about 3 feet a year. And since I've been up, it's spread 100 or so feet through that. This is what it looks like. The tree can still be alive because all it takes is that inner bark and sapwood area for the tree to function to get photosynthates down to the roots and the water and minerals up from the ground. But if this gets into a single root, then it can decay its way on in here with that one root failing. The tree lots of times can be more susceptible to windrow or snow damage. I want to move along to use of the, I guess it'd be natural, I was going to say the unnatural history of valley, used by humans in here. Down at Lucerne, there are some archaeological sites where they have found campfire remains. The natives of the area would come up late at the hunting camps and seasonal use of the area. Down at Donkey Falls, there are some petroglyphs. If you ever get a chance to be in close, you can see them on the block. But with the discovery of a boar in the valley, they had prospecting in the 1800s up here. And what this is trying to show is that, again, in the winter time, this is what it does look like up here. This is a road down near 8 Mile, I believe. So with the prospecting that occurred up here, numerous mine claims, there are cabins and shacks and starts by Hart Lake, by Golden Lake, down valley. Found the remains of a, looks like a Model T that had been modified to run on tracks at the base of the hill at 8 Mile. Not too many people know the history of that particular car. But with the development of Holden Mine, we had the road built up entry here. Also, the power for the mine wasn't from a local hydro. It had power lines that came up all the up late on the far side of Lake Chelan, from Chelan area, crossed over onto the Donkey, and then hopped over and then followed the road here. So along the right side of the slide and the gap in the trees down there, this is the old power line corridor. It's still evident all the way up the valley. It crossed over to the south side of the valley down by 9 Mile and came up on the southern side to the mine site. Another thing that they did with the development of the mine was they relocated Railroad Creek up beyond the vehicle bridge. As you're walking from left to right, look where the camera, where the photo was taken, the river is very close to the bank, and then eventually it bends on away. As it starts to bend on away, that's where the river, original river, used to flow through where the hydro plant is through the tailings. And so I think in 1937 or 38, they diverted this whole creek down on here, put it in log and rock containers to channel it down here so they could expand the mine and tailings. The tailings waste from the mine is another significant impact to the valley. Concerns with contaminants leaching into Railroad Creek. The pH of the water is definitely lower. The macroinvertebrate macro invertebrate life in the creek definitely declines once you get near the vehicle bridge and then on downstream quite a ways. But then it picks up again, and there's a healthy population of petrel in the river creek downstream already.
What's the huge difference between the area where the mine tailings are and the rest of the creek?
Make up an answer. It is much lower, very acidic. I don't have the numbers right here.
There's nothing that's very good for
the tailings? As long as Holden Village has been here, people have been scheming on ways to deal with the tailings. They thought they could send everybody out and build the jar tailings. They thought about using it in concrete blocks and just different ways to use it. We're talking between 8 and 10 million tons of this stuff. The process that they're trying to do now is get a cover on it. Before they've done the excavation and then recovering and reconstructing the tailings, when this picture was taken, they estimated, I think, between 4 to 8 tons of tailings were annually were blown off the tailings down valley. And if you follow the road on down there and wander off, you see the whole forest floor is kind of the same shade of color underneath the annual litter fall.
I have grass full of most everywhere. Too bad it didn't grow on that stuff.
What sort of grass?
Crabgrass.
Yeah, there's some weeds I'd like to get rid of to see if they try to grow in here, but that might be introducing a whole new problem to the valley. Mm-hmm. Before the present village site was built, they had Honeymoon Heights on the other side. And there was an old pack trail which came out from by the ballpark, crossed up, and went up to Honeymoon Heights. The road they put in that you can walk up now came in much later. There's also an aerial tram, cable tram car that came from Honeymoon Heights down toward the ballpark, and there's some concrete structures you can see there left over from that. I'm not sure how long ago it actually happened, but at one point in time they were realizing that the technology they had at the early processing stage of the mine, they were losing a lot of gold that was pumped out in the number one tailings pile. Mm-hmm. And as a way of looking at one, the tailings issue, because they're constantly growing, I think at some point in time there's some concern about just how much this value would be in the tailings. They tried putting a bunch of tailings back into the mine, and they did that for a number of years. And according to what I've heard, is that at one point in time, wherever they were putting it, got saturated and blew out, and there was a slurry of tailings that came out of the portal, washed down over the hillside, came down through this area and settled out down below the mare. And what we have left is some toxic soil in here. This area was dying off when I first came up here in 78. And with all the light, you'd expect the trees to be growing a lot faster. They are growing in there, but because it's buried some of the natural soil level in there, I think changed the pH of the soil in here. It's made it a lot more difficult for these trees to come back. See, again, some of the mortality in there and some of the trees trying to be established. We planted a bunch of them in there, and some of them are still surviving. Some of them had problems that went down so far, and I think it might be because of the buried soil that the roots went down so far, they wouldn't go any farther, they wouldn't be established any better, and the tree would eventually die. Also, we have the Miner's Village to the west of here that the Forest Service, after it was abandoned, I think Holden, the village here was turned over to LBI, and the village began, and the rest of the miners' village, the home sites up there, the Forest Service burned. And that's coming back slowly. We have cotton filling in the area there, but that's another large unnatural opening in the forest up there. In the mid-60s, there was a major timber sale in the valley. The Forest Service had a sale which extended pretty much from the top of Switchbacks just about up to the village here. And what you're looking at here is a view up valley. In the lighter colored area, we see a lot of snow and timber on the south side of the valley. That was thin using cable methods. It was a Swiss system that was brought over. This side of the hillside, they actually had a logging road that went down below. You can still see the stumps from how they selected the cut this side of the valley. And this is looking up one of the thinning corridors. Wintertime, it just shows the contrast of the thinned area, the unthinned area. But they had their logging machine that they would scale all the way, pull all the way up to the top there. And the cables were suspended on down, and they could pull cable out either way to pull the logs in, and then they would lower them gravity all the way down to the road. When I was up here in 1966 as a kid, the bus would have to stop and wait until the logs came down and they loaded them out, and then we could continue on and lay the holding.
Isn't that a fairly, I mean, that sounds like a fairly progressive technique. I mean, is it not? Is that true?
They're doing this nowadays.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, typically now, though, they would try to get a road up there and have the logs be pulled in and pulled up.
Where is this particular patch, huh?
The corridors extend from about, let's see, there's some right near 6 Mile. You can see these. If you go down the Railroad Creek Trail on the far side of the valley, once you go beyond the tailings, you go through a little thick stand of woods there, and then it starts opening up and you'll see stumps. And you can walk down that south side of the valley through quite a distance and see these corridors.
Interesting.
Holden Village is still in the logging business, so to speak. Holden has been burning about 100 cords of wood each year since it started. Sometimes it's more. I don't think it's ever been less than that. Some of the techniques are the same. I think the meals have probably changed. And in the past, Holden was pretty much restricted to just cutting dead standing trees close to the road. So typically the Forest Service would come up, and as they drive up to the village, they'd keep their eyes open. If they'd see a dead tree, they'd paint a number on it. And those are the ones that were being cut. That ended up being a couple impacts that way. One, yes, you're getting rid of a lot of dead trees close to the road there, but you're also targeting a fairly narrow swath of the valley and logging it repeatedly as the trees would die. So one of the imagined considerations was to try to spread it out and get farther off, it would be less visible. Visual impacts had always been fairly significant to the Forest Service of what we do in this valley. When they started doing the tailings rehabilitation work there, they needed a clear cut down near the switchback to get at some of this gravel. So there was an area that was heavily cut over, and that's where this picture was taken from. Again, this is a Holden logger looking down near the switchbacks in that fine pine grass community. I have some photos here that kind of show change and impacts. This area was Holden logging in 1982. And if you can carefully keep in mind, or remember this stump, these trees, this tree in the background. And these here, I'm going to kind of show you how change has happened since this has been done. Again, this is 82. this is that, and it's in backwards. That's same area, basically. The bulldozer trail is gone. These have grown back.
When you say Holden's logging, do you mean logging for cordwood and
building,
or logging for sale?
This is logging for cordwood and also saw timber. A lot of the lumber that Holden used is milled up here.
But there's no other use for it than that?
No, it's not being sold.
yeah, okay.
Down valley, I mean, that. This area here was nearby. The first photo was taken. This was taken about 6 or 7 years afterwards. And there's some pink flowers in here, you can see. That's the lady slipper, the Calypso orchid, which is uncommon. And I know that there's been a lot of concern about the impacts of logging on various plants of vegetation. But it was interesting to see here, and I'm not taking it any farther than what I see, was that after this was logged, after this was a major bulldozer skid trail where you can pull logs down it, this orchid came back thicker in this area than it did off to either side. So the disturbance somehow stimulated the growth of this little orchid. This is that same photo I just showed you before. 2 years later, the trees in the background, you can almost still see the same back, the log down there. This, I believe, is in 95. Now, let's see if I can do these right. This is the Village Main Street in 1982. The reverse doesn't work very well on this, otherwise I'd back it up and run through it all the time. But what I want you to keep in mind is several things. One, the flagpole. Two, where these trees are in relationship to Chalet 1, how much of the building you can see. These trees right along here, and we'll kind of build the time here. So this is 1982. I believe this is 1991. Flagpole's still there. It's good. These little trees have sure grown up. The tree that used to be right here that covered up this side of Chalet 1, it got too big, too close to the building, it was cut down. So this is 91, and this is 95. So I guess the balance, I know on the walk I was on yesterday, and it's going on about the disease and how the valley is in kind of a stage of decline. And everything seems to be dying here and getting ready for a fire or something like that. Like, there is positive change, there are healthy trees. But well, I'll tell you what, there's something else. Yeah, this one tree here is gone now. It's now a chair. And I don't know what else it was turned into as well. But in that little book about the first production years of Holden Village from 38 to whatever, there's a picture taken looking down in the wintertime, and you can see that tree by the pump house when it was only about 6 inches in diameter, about 20-some feet tall. I guess to wrap it up, here a lot of things, old stumps that you see around here, maybe old, they might hold memories for some people. That was the same stump, and that was me when I was up here in 79. So things change. Nothing lasts forever, including the forest. Any questions?
You have a question?
Yeah.
When we were in Stahica, this goes back to the animal life around here. There was a sign saying, "Be aware, there are diamondback rattlesnakes in this area." And I was really interested in the distribution of those snakes. Now, my understanding was that they were on the far side of the lake, which would be the east side of the lake, and they sort of end at Stahican for some reason, but you don't see them too much traveling around the lake to this area. What is that true, and if so, what is the distribution of those creatures?
Oh, sorry, I can't answer that. I can only speculate like you at this time. I'm not sure what the distribution is. I know that Darren was correct. They're on the drier side of the lake over there. And I don't know if it's just the moisture thing. Yeah. I remember when I was up here as a kid in 66, there was apparently somebody reported seeing a rattlesnake up by Park Lake.
Huh.
That some Boy Scouts had been up there and seen one in a couple of days. No, I can't confirm that.
Okay.
I don't know. Okay, that's olive green gray color. Okay. How big was it? Okay, and the tail tapered down enough of the tail fairly blunt. It was blunt. Okay. Yeah, there are these what they call rubber boa. Well,
that way. Yeah. And they're greenish?
No,
yeah, it's all of them. Yeah, I found them out here by
mountain. Yeah, I wasn't afraid of this at all. It's laid in the trail. And we walked around it.
Well, that was really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there anything
that
you would talked about?